Goblin Hood, Satyricon. No, wait. This is tape number 4 of Goblin Hood, Satyricon. Copyright 1995 by James Biotti, read by Goblin Hood. This tape commences somewhere, I think it's in the middle of chapter 21. It's talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Let's go on. Yeah, let's go on, but first I forgot to say this is read by Goblin Hood. The trouble is that I didn't much care about the date back then. Only the day of the week, if that. And frankly, I only remember 2 things about the missile crisis in the first place. But one of them was on TV and the other was on the radio. And together they snapped me out of my childish psychotic fog and woke me up to the events going on around me. Or at least they made me realize that the dream we were all having was probably some kind of nightmare in disguise. And at this I grew pensive in an 11-year-old sort of way. Anyway, my story could probably have happened at any time during that hysterical week, and so I think I'll just arbitrarily assign it to this particular day in question for the sake of neatness. But I remember it as late afternoon, so I must insist on that, and history be damned. And so, let there be light, the long-gone light of a late afternoon in late October, circa the end of the world. But circa once upon a time, some people were probably way too busy for TV anyway, and none, perhaps more than one Colonel Oleg Pinkovsky, a highly placed Russian spy for the West, who had been at it for 1.5 years, not unlike some treasonal addicts that I could name. But see, the problem was that Oleg was a little too busy just then, if you get me, a few too many irons in the fire, so to speak, and perhaps just a tad too many bricks short of a load, if I make myself clear. Or maybe the pressure was just getting to him, you know? In his day job, the good colonel fought sleep or whatever in the guise of Politburo man, ostensible champion of whatever they thought they were doing over there, and who, dressed as mild-mannered senior Soviet military intelligence officer Pinkovsky, probably pretended really hard to be championing whatever exactly their cause was supposed to be. And I won't swear that he wasn't also working for I-Corps, if it comes to that. These spies seem capable of damn near any kind of chicanery, and double agents twice as much so. And anyone this dicey would have fit right in at I-Corps, no sweat. They probably thought Dicey was cool. But Agent Oleg wasn't feeling any too cool just then. He was having the diciest day of them all, having run right smack dab out of time. Oleg had struck it big in the death lottery and was about to be picked up by his KGB buddies for espionage. But he was thoughtful enough to use the last of his precious time toward whipping off a little note to his CIA buddies, probably a rather hurried, encoded message, because he was a busy man just then, in addition to his other duties, official or otherwise. He'd become the nominal protagonist in a prospective alternate history. In fact an actual catalyst for it. And little did he know that his message was actually a world-class John Barr hinge. Hell, how could any of us have known back then? Well, back then, I watched a lot of TV, I guess, and especially in the late afternoon. And I don't know what exactly I was trying to watch when I saw what I saw. But what I saw scared the pluck right out of me. It might have been part of a news bulletin, or maybe it was just some random propaganda set adrift to create even more hysteria and add to all the fun. I guess I'll never know. A hellish voice, that of Khrushchev or his interpreter, or just that of someone with a scary voice, was loudly ranting, "Thee will bury you! Thee will bury you!" The voice was quoting from a Khrushchev speech, I think. Out of context, I believe. And yet there was Nikita himself on the screen, pounding his shoe at the UN, and no doubt doing that out of context as well. And then his image gave way to marching Soviet troops, their hobnailed boots filmed to look as if they'd goose step right over my face, all to the tune of, "We will bury you." It was right out of Orwell, and quite well done as a scare tactic. Maybe they showed bombs going off too, but if so, it didn't register in my memory. I barely remember any of this, just that ranting voice, mostly, and the atmosphere of tension. I was shocked silly, but I was also slowly getting an inkling of what kind of thing, anyway, might be going on, besides me having a bad TV day, that is. And once upon a time, on a bad TV day, the CIA got a rather dicey little message, perhaps just as I was getting the message back home. But their message was from a quantum spy, if he'd already been picked up. And it was as dicey as all hell. And no, quantum is not a Cuban prophylactic, nor a Soviet rubber either. Look it up. But watch closely now, and you'll see the John Barr hinge swing into action, a dicey sight at best. But in this case, in our history, things got pretty dicey, all right. But they also got pretty weird. Oleg's last message warned of an imminent nuclear attack that the Soviets were planning. This was dicey enough, but what happened next took the cake. The CIA ignored the message. Well, now, that's pretty clever. Send spies out to gather information and then just fart off whatever the spies have to say. Unless it's something really important, I guess. The end of the world? Fuck this one, who cares anyway, no problem. What kind of message, one has to wonder, would the CIA have been willing to pay any attention to? Well, not a crazy one like that, anyway. I mean, with the world right on the brink of war, how could anyone honestly believe that the Soviets might be planning a nuclear attack? Enough. When things make so little sense, which is quite often, I'm afraid, you have to just get all ex cathedra about everything to be able to explain anything. Thus, because Ambassador Gardhoff says that the CIA recipients of Pinkovsky's message acted correctly, I'll let it go. That's what they did. And we all know how it turned out in our history. But what if things had happened otherwise? But what if I really if I didn't really see that on TV that day, or any day, I can't prove it after all, and it has been a long time. For that matter, what if all my memories are completely warped or untrue? You see how it is, I guess. I hold something in my hand and can't prove that it's there. But what if it's in the other room? Can I still prove anything without going into the other room? Well, yes, I suppose if I have an official document attesting to the fact, but how can I prove that the document really is official, or that the fact hasn't changed? How can I prove anything? How can one be sure of anything? Maybe the CIA never listens to its spies. What a brilliant policy, to hire advisors and then do the exact opposite of whatever they advise. Now that's subterfuge. Or maybe the CIA is so damned clandestine that nobody ever bothers coming to work, figuring who's gonna know. Maybe Colonel Pinkovsky's message was still just sitting there unopened on somebody's desk years later, when the ambassador finally happened across it and wrote an article about it. Maybe he was just being diplomatic when he said that Pinkovsky's CIA contacts acted correctly. Or maybe that's coded CIA lingo for saying that they were out playing golf. Okay, I admit it. I don't know how the world works. As a lad, of course, I seldom wondered about such things, but the stuff on TV was really scaring me. I needed to tell my mother about it, needed to be reassured. I knew she was in the kitchen, listening to the radio, because I could hear the radio yammering away. I couldn't prove anything, of course, but I was pretty sure of her being in the kitchen, so I thought I'd just head in there and discuss the events of the day. I didn't know it yet, but she was sitting in there crying. And once upon a crying shame, a disturbing message was received by serious men who determined to take it seriously. Why else come to work? Even if it meant acting incorrectly. And so they passed the message on to their superiors, who passed it upstairs, etc., until it finally reached the top. And here's what Gardhoff speculates that would have led to. Had the warning been credited, it could have prompted extreme alert measures and greatly increased tensions and risks. Well, that's possible. And as a contemporary State Department advisor, Gardhoff would probably know what he's talking about here. But it seems just as likely that if a first strike capability was supposed to be good for anything but deterrence, we might have struck first had Kennedy received the message, which, in our history, he didn't even know about at the time. And if the chicken shit bastard hadn't had the guts to strike first with such a clear pretext, well, that's just one more thing we'd have plugged it for in Dallas the next year. Unless you believe in the Easter Bunny, the Tooth Fairy, and the Lone Gunman theory, that is. I mean, a lot of people back then wanted us to strike first, with or without a good pretext. Pinkovsky among them, it would seem. By the way, in our world, and in any alternate ones where no such first strike ever took place, Pinkovsky's fate probably turned out much the same. He doubtless spent the rest of his life smirking in his cell or whatever, whenever he wasn't being tortured, thinking, at least we'll all be dead before I can get shot in the back of the neck, and waiting for the light to be followed by the unheard sound of everybody's telephones melting, as Henry Fonda sort of put it in the film Failsafe, Oleg probably died a very disappointed man, hating the CIA and wondering what if about all kinds of things. The good ambassador describes Oleg thusly. Pinkovsky, sensing that he was about to go down, evidently decided to play Samson and bring the temple down with him. But the CIA, sitting around with their thumbs up their asses, blowing their noses on any warnings that came along, had been Pinkovsky's Delilah, unless I-Corps had, in fact, been clandestinely involved in that little snafu. Anyway, let's defer to the resident State Department expert and do it Gardhoff's way, in which the John Barr hinge simply prompted extreme alert measures. That means, for example, that the USA might have immediately sent its forces to the unprecedented alert level of DEFCON 2, which we did anyway 2 days later in our history. Another John Barr hinge that didn't pan out. But statistically, in some universe or time track, our Pinkovsky-inspired DEFCON 2 would have probably inspired the Soviets to fly into an extremely unprecedented state of DEFCON 3, in which the shit hits the fan, forcing us to counter with DEFCON 4, in which we're already as good as dead, ultimately provoking them to launch DEFCON 5, in which the last sound you'd have heard would have been everybody's telephones melting if the light hadn't gotten you first when one of those 100 megaton jobs they had chanced to strike nearby, and you wouldn't have wanted to be anywhere within 20 or so miles from ground zero for that one, partner. Boy howdy, as in shake hands with God. The end. Sic transit Gloria Mundi and all that. On the other hand, if that denouement isn't your taste, Gardhoff lists at least five other potential John Barr hinges and alludes to even more. These included that DEFCON 2 of October 24th, during which a certain General Powers, without authorization, acted a bit like Stanley Kubrick's crazed fluoridation-hating general in Dr. Strangelove, and the U2 incident on October 27th, in which somebody, apparently Castro, shot down one of our spy planes over Cuba. But was that somebody wearing a quondam at the time? Inquiring minds would like to know. Of course, none of these incidents, oddly, led to jack shit in our world, but on the other side of the hinge, they probably all ended the same way, to wit, the end squared. And just think how many problems that must have solved. Meanwhile, if you're looking for a vacation spot, and you can travel between dimensions, you could do a lot worse than one of those dead worlds once the half-lives have cooled down. You won't find any Pinkovskys there, nor anyone like General Powers. If you like peace and quiet, it would be a great way to get away from it all. Best of all, if you were lucky, you might even get away from me. And me? I just wanted to get away from whatever the damned TV thought that it was doing. I simply couldn't understand what I'd seen, all that crap involving Khrushchev. Had we broadcast that? But it seemed more like Soviet propaganda, or a little covert something from I-Corps, perhaps. Fortunately for everyone on Earth, this was back in the real universe, our world, the one where the CIA can't be bothered with whatever irrelevant drivel its top spies pass along. Anyway, I was confused and disturbed, like a mere child exposed to geopolitical pornography. But I could hear Paul Harvey or some other self-righteous asshole yapping away in the kitchen, passing along the battery-operated scoop about everything to my mom. And I figured she'd be able to sort this out. She could probably make it all go away and lead me back to whatever was left of my childhood. But when I got to the kitchen, I saw my mother crying, almost hysterically. Maybe it was because of my father, a reserve lieutenant colonel in the army, was off playing soldier somewhere and she was lonely. Or maybe she was crying about whatever the radio was blabbering on and on about. As usual, she had her ear glued to it. Maybe she was sad about something, but it seemed more likely that she was just plain terrified. And that terrified me. I'd seen her crying before, but never like this. Never as if she were frightened. And beyond the mild social taboo associated with crying, as if human emotion were somehow shameful, my shock at the time can be explained by an old childhood axiom that anything which could terrify my parent could certainly scare the bejesus out of me. I know she tried to explain it all to me, but I don't remember just what all she said. And in truth, I'm not sure just what I learned that day except for this. I thought there was something wrong with the TV, or with my mother's radio, or even with my mother herself. But now I knew that there was actually something wrong with the world. Good thing this was the buttered side of the bread, n'est-ce pas? But on the other side of the hinge, of many hinges, we didn't live by bread alone, resulting in a far dicier situation than most of us would have wanted to face. But of course, God does not play at dice, or words to that effect, according to Mr. Einstein. True, God usually seems a little too busy pulling wings off of flies and so forth. But even mercy can sometimes be cruel. We lived in a brave new world because of the bomb. But even before 1945, science fiction had predicted genetic miracles, sometimes due to weird radiation. During the 1950s, even insects could grow huge on film in defiance of science, thanks to good old atomic fallout. The Incredible Hulk, created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby for Marvel Comics in the early 60s, achieved the ultimate in nuclear romanticism. By some freak accident, instead of super cancer, radiation could provide superpowers. Wishful thinking? Or mere simplistic plot contrivance? Who cares? It was the consensus attitude of most American ostriches back then. Those, that is, who thought about it at all. Most people, though, simply blamed bad weather on the bomb and let it go at that. Nuclear energy was on its way in to stay and carried all the stigmata of the bomb except for a quick and Queen death, nobody wanted to think about the consequences. It was as if, after making a deal with the devil, we all just occluded the thought of hell from our minds, covering it up with images of Mickey Rooney as the Atomic Kid. And it is a useful gimmick in fiction, this miracles of atomic radiation concept. It can explain almost anything, if only you're willing to ignore reality. And who isn't? But what is reality, anyway? And especially alternate reality. What if, in some other dimension, telekinesis and other such psionic abilities were real? In the country of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. I don't know who said that, but I think Einstein was the chap who postulated that business about atoms all being connected to each other or whatever it is. What if some atoms were somehow aware of this fact and could control all the atoms which weren't? We'd call that mind over matter or something, even if the mind in question only dimly knew what it was doing. Just as dimly as I knew what I was doing with my mind back then. And I doubt that my mother knew what she'd helped to create or to spawn, either in that alternate world or in my own. And at world's end, she probably had other things on her mind. And she tried to explain those things to me, referencing pictures, news reports, and various films that my military father had treated me to, in which the bomb was prominently featured as a benevolent force, our very own little Frankenstein monster, an achievement that we desperately wanted to be proud of. But now she was trying to explain about the meaning of death, in particular the death of the entire human species. But I was barely listening at this point, lost in the latest of a series of precognitive visions that I'd been having lately. This one focused on a more solitary death, just a year and a half or so in the future. Back in my own universe, I was mercifully spared the dubious benefits and pleasures of precognition. So I didn't know how things would turn out. I didn't know that Colonel Pinkovsky's megalomaniacal little jape would bite the big one. I didn't know that the human race would somehow, against all odds and with a little passive help from the CIA, go blundering mindlessly on into the future, unchecked by the consequences of our madness. But my mother was as relieved as anyone when it all blew over, and I like to remember her that way, tranquil, relaxed, and peaceful, before our own problems started escalating. And perhaps in some retrospective dimension, she still exists like that, frozen in time, happy and relieved and facing almost a whole new life, about a year and a half before I killed her. And even across the hinge, I couldn't have told you the year or date of the month. Even here, my mind has always oddly occluded those with dogged, stubborn obstinacy. But it was February, and it was either Washington's or Lincoln's birthday. I remember this detail because it's another John Barr hinge, I guess, a pivotal fact on which subsequent events are largely based. But that could easily describe this entire scenario. For that matter, as could this quote from Nathaniel Hawthorne's story, The Christmas Banquet. There was a man of nice conscience who bore a blood stain in his heart, the death of a fellow creature, which for his more exquisite torture had chanced with such a peculiarity of circumstances that he could not absolutely determine whether his will had entered into the deed or not. Therefore, his whole life was spent in the agony of an inward trial for murder, with a continual sifting of the details of his terrible calamity, until his mind had no longer any thought, nor his soul any emotion, disconnected with it. Maybe Hawthorne was a little precognitive, you know? Anyway, it was the kind of holiday where my father could somehow get the day off, even though I had to go to school. And if he'd gone to work that day like he was supposed to do, maybe none of this would have happened. Or I could blame the Amish, I guess, because that's where my parents proposed to go that day, to some Amish village an hour or so away, to buy produce or something. But the Amish certainly weren't to blame for the terrible technology involved, and especially not for my technology. And even in my own world, the technology was central to the event, even to the event's precursor, in the form of an argument that I had with my mother that morning while I waited for the school bus to come along. Even the bus was central. My mother was getting pretty sick of me missing the bus at the end of the school day. She knew, of course, that I missed it on purpose, so as to hang around with my friends after school. She probably didn't know how important that was to me, how it represented the only freedom that I felt I had. Nor did she seem to care about how much I hated the school bus and the other kids on it, or about how little I liked coming home anyway. What mattered to her was that she not have to come pick me up after school again. The proposed junket to Amishville would have made that kind of problematic on this day in any case, but she was only just learning to drive and had already had at least one accident, and so she hated to have to come after me at all. And as a mere psychotic brat, I, of course, didn't understand the kinds of pressures I was putting her under, nor how much reason I'd given her, by her standards, for outright loathing me. Reasons I would sooner not enumerate here, but kid stuff, you know? For dysfunctional kids, anyway. I only knew that I wanted to be left alone to survive, like any other organism, according to my own lights and in accordance with my own self-image, and that because of her selfishness, I wouldn't get to on this particular day. And over yonder, I sensed that this particular day might have been in February of 1964, though the idea faded at once from my memory, even as I tried to retain it. This psychic occlusion can be a pretty funny business. Well, not funny. As if my not being able to focus on the year is supposed to keep me from knowing about the event. A good point, perhaps, in some strange ways, though half-baked in others. I mean, look what self-recognition did for jolly old Oedipus Rex. But speaking of funny business, how the hell can precognition work, assuming it could ever work at all, in a world which branches off futuristically every time anyone makes a decision? I figure it this way. First, that being self-involved, I'd only notice the branchings that immediately concerned me. And second, that certain trends are more likely to emerge than others, given certain fixed and immutable factors and certain likely conclusions and certain dynamic forces, so that the February massacre was the most likely conclusion, perhaps somehow even the most desirable conclusion, from my childish point of view, of course, in most of the nearby worlds, to our surviving the missile crisis together, or something. And in any case, given this particular precognitive alternate in question, I'd have to have been scanning those nearby futures anyway, as events will soon make painfully clear. And what did I see there? I saw the quarrel escalate and begin splurging over into areas which certainly neither of us truly wanted to explore, neither of us truly being in the right. For an argument is a small struggle for power, in which the power comes from being right, or from already having the power to make the opponent concede, grudgingly or otherwise. And in terms of actual power, my mother seemed to have it all, right or wrong. But I could always win by missing the bus anyway if I were willing to face the consequences. And, as in all power struggles, neither of us really gave a damn about anything but winning, as if the struggle for power gains its own blind, unreasoning impetus, like some violent sex act, until winning is like an orgasm, oft followed, as in this case, by a kind of cold, wet, sticky return of the rational senses, followed in turn, particularly in a case like this, by a horrified inventory of the damage done. I saw, for example, in my precognitive agony, that some of those undesirable conversational areas would touch upon the very difficult puberty that I'd been having or would be having, a subject about which I was, am, will be, extremely repressed and almost incapable of speaking. And in the argument, my incoherence lapsed into childish profanity and fury. At what? At her own guilt, of course, in not teaching me better, in being so fucking repressed herself that sex was never even brought up. Even as a child, I could sense a trap here, a double bind, that my puritanical parents had abandoned me to learn about this important aspect of life in the gutter, and that, having learned by the savage rules of the gutter, I was thenceforth damned in their holier-than-thou eyes. But no responsibility was theirs. Oh, no. I was the one who ate the apple. All they did was leave me in the garden, hoping, apparently, that I'd have better sense. And perhaps she sensed her own share of blame for some of that, because she soon abandoned any reasoned arguments and attempted to win the battle by main force, that is, by invoking a higher power of sorts. And I heard my mother threaten me with the worst fate of them all, that she'd tell my father about some of my deep, dark secrets and get me beaten half to death and sent off to military school, a popular and fearsome bugbear which they both relied heavily upon in these little chats, even my father, who'd been to a military school himself. And I heard my last words to her, snarled as I left to catch the bus. Why don't you just drop dead? Why don't you just go to hell? And I saw myself laughing last and best. Or so I thought. But damned if she didn't have me worried, even in this world. And I spent the whole day worrying about it at school. True, she'd made idle threats before, but we'd never argued with this much intensity before. And like any kid in such circumstances, or so I'd really like to suppose, I began trying to daydream of a way out, just to ease some of the inner worry and tension. But the only possibility that I could imagine where I'd wind up truly safe from her wrath involved her sudden death, which is how things were usually resolved, by the way, in the teachings of my greatest mentor up to that point, that wise old sage known as Television, in whose didactic little parables the bad guys, i.e. my mother, had to routinely die before the last commercial break. And I even saw where it could actually happen. What with them driving around in foul weather looking for that Amish settlement. And I began hoping for that, behind my own back, as it were. No details, of course. I didn't have to hope that she'd go flying through the windshield and die instantly, which might have been awfully damned merciful of me, had I even thought about it. But no, I just wanted her dead. And after a while, I started wanting it really badly. And I was still wanting it, even praying for it. When the school's principal came to get me out of shop class to tell me the big news. But it seemed as if I still had some choice in the matter. Because the principal, when he stood facing me in his office, had a hard time getting to the point. "It's hard to have to tell you this," is in fact how he began. "But there's been a terrible accident." And the next instant seemed an eternity, with a wise old owl flapping and yapping in the back of my mind, and "hoo, hoo," comprised the beast's limited vocabulary. Could it be either, or both? And as the school principal cleared his throat, I had more than enough time to be cold and logical. Nothing personal, you will, of course, understand. But I wanted her dead anyway. Had been wanting it, in fact, all day long. And I realized that with him dead, I'd be a total orphan, and one with no visible means of support. And so he survived as the principal launched those fatal words, "Your mother's dead, and your father's in critical condition." But his condition wasn't even all that critical, as it turned out. And even my precognitive alternate was appalled at how callous and subhuman I could be, as if telekinetic matricide were the moral equivalent of pragmatically drowning kittens. But he could also look ahead to the long years of occlusion, during which I could never actually believe that she was really dead. The years during which I just kept waiting around for the joke to be over, for reality to come slinking back with an embarrassed smirk on its face, the years I put in trying to forget about her funeral and about the horrible chorus thundering in my mind, "We will bury you." And from this precognitive alternate life, I looked ahead and saw the vast psychotic episode of 1975, during which I finally, painfully, maddeningly, faced the reality of her death, and after which I began gropingly to put the pieces of my shattered life back together again. I even saw that it would sort of work out for the best, as I eventually resolved never to do anything psionic again, and to live on as harmlessly as possible. It was, in fact, this little passion play with its attendant resolve that would get me safely through the Marcin crisis years later. But I saw, too, that I'd never be truly happy again, and worse, that I'd never stop hating myself for what I'd done, pragmatic or otherwise. Among other horrors, I watched myself, over the years, ruin my mind with various weird drugs, trying to run away from it, trying to forget. And one of those drug trips, a mushroom that I ate in late 1973, gave me an idea. And I wasn't even thinking about my mother when I ate the mushroom. I'd become really good by then at not thinking about her. No, I was just trying to have fun. And it was some fun, let me tell you, when I got off on the shroom and felt myself detonate like a bomb, felt everything fall away until I towered over my environment as a mushroom cloud, miles high, yes. And it must have been some mushroom that I took as well. And it was only my visibility there, my high profile, the fact that I could be seen for miles around by people who would want to investigate. Only this collapsed me back into my little room to hide there, tripping my brains out, but trying to be a little less obvious about it. And that may have been the first nuclear strike in the drug war, for all I know, except that I took it back. Anyway, it proved highly inspirational to my precognitive alternate a door or two up or down the matrix back in 1962. As it happened, or might have happened, back in 1962, I looked ahead and didn't think much of the future I saw. And I especially felt sorry for my mother, who would be killed so coldly in so many alternate histories for the crime of spawning a genetic mutant, of whelping a monster. I felt sorry for everyone, in fact, even for poor, pompous Paul Harvey. The entire human race was in the position of those hopeless citizens of Peaksville, the little town from Jerome Bixby's story, It's a Good Life, which appeared on Rod Serling's Twilight Zone series, starring little Billy Mummy as the mad god Anthony. The fools! How could any of them have known that Anthony was my middle name? Well, at least it must have pleased Penkovsky when I canceled the future, when I went off on behalf of my mother and of everyone else, trying for a neat, frothy little bubble-like effect, similar to footage I'd seen of one of the earliest bikini blasts. But you need too much water for that effect, I guess. Instead, I became a vast, unimaginable hemisphere of light, after, that is, the initial blinding, searing flash. And as I reached the breakaway point, and the air around me cooled enough to be seen through, I probably looked more like Castle Bravo, that massive nuclear faux pas, sporting mighty condensation rings, festooned with bells, hoops, and skirts, let alone ice caps, and yielding untold megatons. And as I hovered there, at the grateful end of the world, dying collectively in such a worthy cause, as my great self-sacrifice prompted extreme alert measures and greatly increased risks and tensions and led, in fact, to Penkovsky's little wet dream war. as I perished magnificently there, bestowing a kind of half-life upon my remaining surroundings, and tucking my mother and everyone in for the long night, to spare them further anguish and pain at my hands, my mind was very much focused upon the quality of mercy. And in my final moments, when the fun was almost over, and the fallout was already starting to fall out, I couldn't help thinking of myself as Saint Cloud, 22. And the real Saint Cloud? It strikes me now that my more astute readers will already have postulated that Saint Cloud was simply one of my alternates in some slightly different world line than my home con. Which is an interesting theory. One might also speculate that in his world, for some absurd reason, artists like him had no access to typing equipment, let alone to alternate dimensions. That would even explain his big treasonal panic, wouldn't it? He never thought to ask me why I didn't just bring some from next door, plausibly or otherwise. But of course, the possibility also exists that St. Cloud didn't know the facts, didn't even know that there were other worlds. Perhaps he simply thought I was, purely by coincidence, some weird doppelganger of his from his own world. Maybe we didn't even look that much alike. Who happened to have access to a computer or something. Or something. At any rate, I could see that having to turkey out because of treasonal didn't really become him, and his obsession seems to have gotten even worse than ever. The next time I went there, Smiley was there. He wore a khaki trench coat with a hat, more khaki colored than otherwise, except for the sweat stains, whose mother might have been a trilby and whose father might have been a fedora. This was pulled down over his eyes. His feet were on his desk, actually a coffee table, and the floor was littered with novels by Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. Smiley had his feet up, almost as high as the cigarette dangling from his mask, and was drinking coffee but was pretending it had whiskey in it. He was writing up a report or something, probably the last installment of Labyrinth of Venereal Vestals, which I admit is a pretty sucky title. I know it looks weird, began Smiley, but cripes, you ought to see the boss wearing this rig down the street. People laugh out their windows at him and call him Inspector Clouseau. Aha, was all I could think to say. He's taken to saying things like, Smiley, you know my methods, and elementary, my dear dinosaur. His favorite maxim has become, once you eliminate the impossible elements from a situation, you find that, well, nothing is possible. What the fuck does he think he's doing? I saw fit to wonder. Oh, you know, was Smiley's languid reply. Tracking down truth and all that, trying to affix blame over this treasonal disaster, but mostly stumbling upon a long list of dead people, including his own mother, and trying to figure out who's responsible before it all gets blamed on him. He's probably also searching diligently for any remaining stockpiles of treasonal out there, though I'm sure he's got his own stash around here somewhere. I saw fit to change the subject. How's Lickjaw these days? Well, see, we don't call him that these days, or he gets pissed off. But he needed his own name, so we compromised on Glittermouth, because of the teeth, you know? But he's been acting pretty weird himself lately. He's always muttering things like, "The microcephalon is silent," and "To the dark star." I don't get it. Well, I can help you there. That last is the title of a story by Robert Silverberg. It's got a character in it called the microcephalon. Actually, the relationships within the story have always reminded me a lot of Richard Lupoff's post-Lovecraftian tale, Discovery of the Gurik Zone. "Uh-huh," responded Smiley. "But what would Silverberg's story have to do with Glittermouth?" "I've no idea," I replied, "but we can probably find out soon enough." Then, like a true bibliophilic detective, I stepped over to St. Cloud's haphazard bookcase. Ah, here it is. I pulled an old paperback out of a remote, dusty stack. Smiley looked at the book. "Best SF, 1968, edited by Harry Harrison and Brian Aldiss, Berkeley Medallion, 1969. "It's in there," I said. "Look it up. I can see where Glittermouth would enjoy it. It's pretty cynical, but it's also a great story." Then I made a great show of checking out a nearby clock. I didn't really care what time it was, but the atmosphere of depression pervading St. Cloud's place, and even pervading Smiley, was beginning to infect my soul. "Well, hey, I gotta run. Tell St. Cloud his latest chapter is almost finished, so I'll be back soon." If Smiley noticed my sarcasm about the great project, he gave no outward sign. "By the way, regards to the dinosaur, how's he taking all this treasonal deprivation?" "Oh, you know," was said about as unaffably as Smiley could manage. "He's just plain flipping out. We'll be lucky if he doesn't go all Spider Day on us." "You mean by having flashbacks or something?" I inquired, because of them old inquiring minds, you know. "I'm not sure what I mean," muttered Smiley, glumly for him, and he saw me to the door. And it was hard for me to tell, either, just what Smiley had meant by that last cryptic remark, although the Spider Day reference was clear enough, to me anyway. So there it was. In any case, their whole world was beginning to collapse, at least in their own eyes. Smiley was looking like an idiot and losing all his sang-froid. Glittermouth was getting petulant and raving about some science fiction yarn from yesteryear, and St. Cloud apparently thought he was running the local branch of I-Corps, the benevolent fraternity of hardcore, hard-boiled private eyes, or whatever. Only St. Cloud wasn't some hard-boiled dick, or even a soft-boiled dick, more like a poached weenie. or even just a dickhead, the poor bastard, and the dinosaur, messing up as usual, making everything worse. This was all the fault of the goddamn fucking dinosaur, just like I figured. Or so it was easy enough to tell myself. Anyway. Speaking of easy, it's easy to understand how a sad-assed jerk like St. Cloud could have developed a big predilection for stimulants. And I could even see Smiley having a good time on laughing gas, or imagine a specimen like Sparkletooth or whoever getting off with something like PCP or even airplane glue. At least those vices would seem tailored to the kinds of personalities involved, hence making some kind of sense. But the dinosaur took the fucking cake. He'd wallowed in whatever drug came his way, with one exception. He never shoved anything. He was scared to death of hypos and never did any needlework except during one very notable exception, an extremely absurd exception, which is as good a place as any to start. The dinosaur was probably 10 or younger, just a juvenile Jurassic asshole who called himself Dino and wanted to act grown up. He figured that drinking was as good a place as any to start, probably because both his parents drank like fish, but also because all the grown-ups did it on TV, and because the 20s novelist Thorne Smith, author of Topper, made it sound like fun, and because Edgar Allan Poe made it sound almost like a prerequisite for a fledgling bohemian artist, which was Dino's only viable career option. By the way, I might add that all of the preceding glorification of alcoholism took place as a direct consequence of free speech and of the utter failure of prohibition, except for Poe, that is, who just plain took place. There was just one little problem with drinking for the young dinosaur, which was that he couldn't stand the taste of alcohol. But he got around that after his grandparents died. One of them had been diabetic and had left a fix kit for insulin among their effects, which Dino happened to chance upon before his parents did. And could this mean that he himself might be genetically predisposed to said disease? He'd heard horror stories about people hallucinating from the onset of diabetes, which he thought of in his ignorance as insulin shock, and then there was the daily horror of the needle. But would Dino in his condition even notice it if said hallucinatory circumstances descended upon him, if he started wanting to walk downtown via the basement of his house, or worse yet, proposed to drive someplace in an old rabbit-headed Pez dispenser? An interesting question, possibly for discussion at a later time. At this time, however, he was all set with his unauthorized works there, and whenever he was alone in the house, he'd raid the liquor cabinet, fill the hypo with bourbon or something, and squirt the stuff towards his mouth in tiny streams that could hardly even be tasted. What an ingenious idea, right? Before long, he was mixing it with iced tea, and in a few years, he was wrecking cars, drunk on underage beer, and blacking out frequently, let alone puking and pissing himself all over town after whoever had gotten him drunk for whatever purposes was finished with him. And had he ever acquired a true taste for this stuff, he would doubtless, like Alexander, have drunken himself to death. But that was only the beginning of Dino's travails, living in a rural backwater during the dawn of commercial television had left other marks on the reptilian SOB. Does anyone out there remember the great cigarette commercials of the 50s and early 60s? If not, they're easy enough to reconstruct. Take the average 90s era anti-drug brainwashing crud, or even anti-smoking propaganda in the age of Joe Camel, and then turn it all around. Instead of the nubile or virile sex object yapping about how out of it someone is for smoking or toking or whatever, have the same plastic people sucking up to some wheezing chainer on TV saying things like, so-and-so is such an asshole for not smoking coffin nails, or only real he-men can handle cancer sticks, or even hell mells are smoother, more satisfying, and you aren't even human if you don't smoke, and so on. Dino was smoking upwards of 3 packs a day by his high school days. He later started rolling his own at a slightly lower economic cost in order to keep up with the addiction, which at least explains why some of these experimental little sorties were more persistent than others. The addictive qualities seemed to vary in intensity, and smoking, for that matter, didn't carry the immediate stigmata of, say, drunkenness. But the poor dumb fuck also had the misfortune to have to attend high school during the late 1960s, the age of the outsider, but only of the ones who were in with the in crowd. The time when authority was widely hated and feared, and when experimental and recreational drugs were widely regarded as a sort of wild card secret weapon, and were in fact a secret ingredient of the whole so-called hippie scene. The dinosaur was even well outside of being an outsider, and he would have gladly been in with the in crowd if he'd known how. But his real interest in all this was a deep-seated desire to know what the fuck was going on, a desire which he eventually built into the earliest version of Raymond St. Cloud. And in high school, St. Cloud wrote an English lit term paper about the hippie scene, as he called it, an asinine and naive document written from his vantage point in his isolated and alienated Midwestern ivory tower, with said alienation being perhaps his only true qualification for writing such a thing. On the other hand, the term paper had to be about something, and anything the fledgling scholar attempted to write about would have doubtless been padded with unutterable bullshit. One of St. Cloud's only talents was to be able to dream up something to say, stupid or otherwise, about anything or nothing. As matters stood, St. Cloud's pathetic scholarly yammerings derived a lot of bogus and heavily biased information from periodicals such as Life, Newsweek, and the like, as well as a few more direct gems of wisdom from Hunter Thompson's book on the Hell's Angels, which seemed a related field, and so on. Later on in his life, St. Cloud actually traveled to such historic sites as Haight-Ashbury, Greenwich Village, and the Sunset Strip, the places he'd written about, to see if he'd missed anything, the stooge. On the other hand, at least that proves he had more than a facile interest in what was probably an extremely facile subject. Even in high school, it had become clear to the teenage sociologist that drugs seemed to be a big part of the scene, and that they could perhaps explain some of its more glaring anomalies, glaring to him anyway. Life hadn't prepared him, as an example, for the first time he listened to Zappa's Mothers of Invention, the absolutely free album. But then, what could prepare a dull-witted, out-of-it fool like St. Cloud for something like that? Well, drugs might, he decided, as an off chance. Unfortunately, St. Cloud was stymied in his quest for knowledge by this fact. Most of the real drugs involved in what the hippies were doing, like pot and acid, were unavailable to him where he was. So he had to fall back on crappy and truly experimental substitutes. These included airplane glue sniffing and wretched attempts to smoke banana peels. A big in-joke at the time, Mellow Yellow it was called. St. Cloud also tried to liquefy heads of lettuce in a blender and drink that for the lettuce opium. He even, pathetically, smoked tea bag tea and cigarettes soaked in perfume. This last an experiment of his own. Most of these efforts didn't work very well in terms of getting St. Cloud high, whatever that was. Sadly, even his first taste of real pot and hash during the summer of 69 was sort of a letdown. But what did work was something that he tried later that summer after talking to a mysterious stranger while he was hitchhiking around somewhere. This stranger was a college hippie and thus spoke with some authority about tripping, in St. Cloud's estimation anyway. The stranger told St. Cloud the secret ingredients of something called green slime, made with common household, or at least over-the-counter, ingredients. In the stranger's words, "This stuff is even heavier than LSD, man. You'll get so high you can talk to dead people." Yes, and even back then, St. Cloud had a list of dead people that he wanted to talk to, chief among them his sainted mother, whose tragic death, the true circumstances of which his mind had handily occluded, St. Cloud had never troubled himself to very thoroughly explore. And it was very typical of him, even back then, not to wonder whether he might not wind up talking to dead people permanently on their side of the veil, as he whipped up a batch of murky, scum-flavored green slime, the most active ingredient of which was a well-known satanic herb and toxic hallucinogen popular among certain witch cults of medieval vintage and on up. And though the stuff looked and tasted like green slime, St. Cloud ultimately came to think of it as Spider Day due to its most prominent effect. But it was just another John Barr hint. I mean, think of all the worlds where St. Cloud never drank any Spider Day and never became St. Spider Day for a day on one fine Spider Day way back when, but instead went on to become a well-adjusted CPA or something. But back in St. Cloud's real universe, the only one I've been talking about in regards to him, the only one that he's allowed to use, the Spider Day question was resolved with a damn the torpedoes attitude. And it went like this. He first became Spider Day on an early Spider Day morning after drinking the Spider Day on the night before and promptly passing the hell out. No new Spider Day for him, as it happens. But he woke up in a brave new Spider Day with his head swimming and melting on Spider Day and no memory whatsoever of the previous night's Spider Day incident, and only a vague inkling that everything wasn't quite the way that it should be where he was on Spider Day or on any other day, and that all the weird Spider Day all over everything and the Spider Day feeling all over his mind might just be some sort of clue as to what this Spider Day might be. But he mostly remained clueless as he watched the spider hordes that were everywhere frolic and gamble in their Spider Day rites and festivities, and he vaguely wondered, to the extent that he still could, why he'd never noticed all the Spider Day manifestations everywhere before, like those Spider Day things under the bed and in the corners of the walls, and especially like that horrible Martian Spider Day horror crawling and slithering across his belly, coming toward his face, and he leaped up, only to find that he'd been lying upon a whole nest of them, squirming like hideous centipedes in the Spider Day depression of his bed. Well, so he jumped up and tried to adjust to the Spider Day everywhere, but it was easier said than done when he couldn't even find a pack of Spider Day around, though whenever he really wanted one, it would just appear between his fingers. But they had a disconcerting Spider Day of vanishing abruptly between his fingers whenever he tried to smoke them. It was like talking to dead people who had nothing to say or who weren't really there, and who probably only appeared at all in deference to the awesome Spider Day power of suggestion and of the great god nicotine addiction. But things seemed better outside at first, where more Spider Day could naturally be expected to be down yonder in the grasslands, even if half the Spider Day was from other planets or something, where they said in weird trilling voices things like, "Hey, Mr. Spider Day, did you ever Spider Day on a Spider Day that was in the Spider Day of a Spider Day called Spider Day, with or without using any Spider Day, while you made yourself Spider Day up and down and Spider Day with your Spider Day until it started to Spider Day a bunch of Spider Day all over Spider Day?" And of course there was precious Spider Day that Spider Day could Spider Day to this. And it seemed like even the trees were kind of all Spider Day down yonder in the grasslands of the Spider Day yard in the sickly Spider Day light. And you wouldn't believe just how Spider Day they all were, whether they really existed or not, down yonder in the Spider Day grasslands. And he may or may not have been trying to Spider Day a tree in its problematical, hypothetical Spider Day down yonder when the Spider Day neighbors called the Spider Day police. And everything was totally Spider Day after that, because Spider Day didn't even Spider Day what was starting to Spider Day when they got him to Spider Day into the Spider Day. And he rode along, but he kept on having to Spider Day out every time they tried to Spider Day him Spider Day, or decided to Spider Day him upside the Spider Day, or whatever they were doing, or so he always seemed to remember, if that word can be considered truly applicable at Spider Day in a Spider Day like this. And at the Spider Day they seemed to keep asking him if he was Spider Day, to which he always replied, "Spider Day," while admitting, according to rumors he heard later, that he wanted to be a frog when he grew up and went to college next Spider Day. And otherwise, he put in his Spider Day watching Phantom cigarettes and joints, Spider Day right down to Spider Day between his very fingers, the whole Spider Day time. And he never knew for sure just what other kinds of Spider Day things might have happened then, though he always knew that some of the possible things might have been very Spider Day indeed. For instance, they might have called in old Dr. Spider Day and his Spider Day nurse, who, as it might have turned out, couldn't make Spider Day nor Spider Day out of the case, but who didn't like it anyway because the whole fucking Spider Day was going to the Spider Day, and because it was Spider Day punks like this who were primarily Spider Day. So maybe they decided to Spider Day his Spider Day just to be on the Spider Day side, or maybe they even saw fit to Spider Day his Spider Day just to see what kind of Spider Day might be in there and to get to the Spider Day of things without any fucking Spider Day whatsoever. Or maybe they all just sat around and played cards. Five card Spider Day, perhaps. Likewise, he never knew for sure just how he managed to get away with the whole thing and to avoid serious repercussions, other than that his getaway started the next morning when he woke up to find all the Spider Day gone now and everything all better now. Or was it? Maybe it depends on which side of the hinge you're on or something. For instance, it would be bad enough for a simple human Spider Day to Spider Day his mind on the one Spider Day, but suppose he was one of those Spider Day gaping psionic mastermind types, whether aware of it or not, and suppose the Spider Day which befell his helpless mind also managed to Spider Day the helpless universe that his Spider Day mind was connected to and sort of in control of. What kind of Spider Day would that be for everyone else in the shoddy, half-assed Spider Day universe that he managed to Spider Day together with his Spider Day mind when he woke up on that monstrous morning, on that momentous morning after Spider Day with a Spider Day hangover that wasn't to be believed? And who could you expect to ever Spider Day it anyway? And in that case, does it really even Spider Day anyway? Or what? In any case, it's not too surprising that after a Spider Day fiasco like that, very few hallucinogens were any more than so much water off a duck's ass to old St. Cloud, who experimented liberally with acid, mescaline, and psilocybin during his college years, though nothing ever made him Spider Day out again. Not that he really wanted to, you understand. There were strange incidents, though, at times. Like the time he mixed acid with sopers and wound up crawling around on the floor with a paper bag over his head, singing the theme song from the old Monkees TV show, and worse. Basically, though, the highest he ever got on this other stuff was during the early 1970s, while watching Frank Zappa's film 200 Motels at a seedy theater in a seedy, run-down, redneck-type district of town. He dropped some ass-kicking, window-pane acid just before the flick started, and his mind came apart at the seams as the movie progressed. He'd expected the movie-slash-drug combo to sort of slap his mind around, but instead Zappa kicked his head to pieces with a non-sequitur sensory assault that, among other things, made rednecks seem very scary indeed to St. Cloud, who was stuck here watching this in the very midst of a redneck citadel, as it seemed to him. St. Cloud actually pissed his pants, while glued to his seat there. And then, because it was a double feature, he had to sit through Woody Allen's Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex in wet pants and a really splashed mindset. But usually he just turned into a temporary mushroom cloud or something. And as Saint Spider Day might have said, "Say magnifique mais ce n'est pas la Spider Day." Anyway, St. Cloud once told me, shortly after things fell apart for him, that he was planning to get through his obligatory treason-all-kicking routine by bracing himself with commercial and still available caffeine pills, as poor a substitute for treason-all as they truly were. But he was worried about rumors concerning possible effects of caffeine on the prostate gland. Interestingly, this was the first sign he'd shown of actually giving a shit what any of the drugs did to his health, though I think I'd actually scared him into that this time by directing his attention to that particle theory tale. St. Cloud, who was afraid of doctors to begin with, also seemed to feel that he'd had quite enough weird things up his ass already, thank you very much, and could, in fact, become downright speechless on the subject, even compared to his usual level of inarticulateness. This was another long story, and one it were probably best to leave the dinosaur out of for a change, but also a story which is extremely germane to that weird paper harem of drawings that had inspired St. Cloud's Labyrinth of Venereal Vestals manuscript. Actually, I don't exactly know how to explain this stuff about St. Cloud, except to mention that in most continua familiar to me, nature, human and otherwise, seemed a little haywire during the latter days of the 20th century. It was a time of environmental chaos, when things like the death of the ozone layer were almost taken for granted, even though they were also creating rather a bit of a sticky wicket for man and beast alike. That is, in any case, how I'd explain a phenomenon like the samurai squirrel, sometimes known as the shogun squirrel. This furry little fat-tailed bastard was one of the greatest terrorists of the age, considering his deeds in proportion to his size and station in life. The animal in question was written up in Central Ohio's largest newspaper, or was it USA Today, during the first week of March 1993. Shortly after the World Trade Center and the Waco, Texas thing exploded. And while the bombing and the David Koresh Branch Davidian caper both dominated the news at that time, other newsmakers, such as the Samurai Squirrel, were also busy making news. The dashing rodent was part of a true story, half heartwarming, half sarcastic, all bizarre, buried somewhere within the paper's depths. It seems that the creature I call the Samurai Squirrel invaded a building in some hick town and took an entire office hostage one fine day in 1993, evidently scampering around and chattering angrily at people and or something. I'm reporting this from memory. It wouldn't go away. this apparently disgruntled woodland and parkland denizen. And yet this was no ordinary squirrel, as I seem to remember the paper coyly putting it. No, this squirrel was a flaming, gaping pain in the ass and was madder than hell to boot. Probably because someone had been feeding it, I guess. The paper mentioned that the poor babies can get real outraged if people dare to try and feed them. And hell, anybody can understand that, right? But this mere nuisance, the samurai squirrel, earned the nickname of Shogun Squirrel from me. After the local cops showed up to deal with the problem. Because somehow, in the course of some sort of effort at catching the squirrel, the local sheriff's pants fell down in front of everybody, as was so thoughtfully reported by the paper in the spirit of human interest. Then, no doubt after a bit more angry, young, self-righteous posturing and chittering, the Shogun squirrel made a mad dash out the window and scampered away, never to be seen again, probably gloating to itself and figuring that nobody would ever dream of feeding it again, by God. It brought a cop's pants down in the papers yet and got away scot-free. It counted coup on an office full of people and made a total buffoon out of the law's representative, and yet went on to perhaps even greater escapades, cultivating that old legend, the legend of the Shogun squirrel. Yet, of course, no ordinary squirrel could do this. But a samurai squirrel with an ambitious eye on the squirrel shogunate? That's obviously another matter entirely. My point, a lot of strange things were happening during those dying decades of the 20th century. The Shogun squirrel was only one of them. So anyway, I guess I'd better just get on with this here little tale of woe before the squirrels start busting up the furniture or something. Maybe they've been breeding with those hardy or foolhardy desert mice out yonder in the southwest. The ones who go out dashing. The ones who go dashing out to beat scorpions up and have them for dinner. Not many of us could stomach that. And me, I wouldn't even invite a scorpion into my house, much less have it for dinner. Most people wouldn't. One guy who probably would have, though, by reputation anyway, was the Marquis de Sade. Anybody remember him as the basis of this whole St. Cloud digression, perchance? De Sade would probably have palled around with scorpions and then some.